Welcome to Questions That Matter. This is a podcast of the C.S. Lewis Institute. I'm your host, Randy Newman. I have the great privilege of serving with the Institute as the Senior Fellow for Apologetics and Evangelism. And as such, my role is to try to encourage the weaving of outreach, the weaving of evangelism into our discipleship. And so every so often on this podcast, Questions That Matter, we push it in the direction of how does this make a difference in our outreach, in our talking to non-Christians, in conversing with outsiders. So today, I'm alone in the studio. I don't have a conversation partner today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the tone of our evangelism. We talk a lot about the content of our evangelism, and that's rightly so. We want to get the content right. We want to make sure that we're proclaiming the gospel accurately, according to what the scriptures actually do teach. But we also want to have the right flavor, the right tone. I think an important place to begin this discussion is in the scriptures. And quite often when I get invited to speak for one of our C.S. Lewis Institute fellows groups or a special event or at a church, I focus my remarks on Colossians 4, 2 through 6. So if you've heard me speak, you've probably heard me address this passage, or perhaps even on this podcast, I've launched into it a bit. Let me read this text and then just make a few comments about the tone of our evangelism. Colossians 4, beginning in verse 2, reads this way. Continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us that God may open to us a door for the word to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear which is how I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. I'm not going to do a thorough exposition of this text, but I do want to set it in the larger picture, the context. And this is a passage about prayer and proclamation. And I hope you caught that they're sort of seamlessly woven together, or there's not a pause or a break after Paul says to continue steadfastly in prayer and pray at the same time that God would open up a door. And for you too, also to pray for God to open up a door, and for you too, to conduct yourself with wisdom, and for you too, to let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt. So there is this tone in this passage about the supernatural nature of evangelism. The very fact that we need to be in prayer about it and even watchful in it, maybe looking to see how the Lord might be guiding us during the prayer time. There's a need for watchfulness and thankfulness, thanking God for the way He has answered prayers, how He worked in your life so that you came to faith, and thankful for the people that He's placed around you who are non-Christians. I realize that the application of this passage has much broader application, but I'm zooming in on evangelism and our witness, and I think that that's legitimate. So I do acknowledge there's more to this passage, but for the sake of this podcast and my role in encouraging you in evangelism, I want to look at it through those lenses. I do think it's interesting that he uses the word proclaim, or declare is the way the ESV says it. So there's something about evangelism that's just laying it out there. It's saying, here's what I believe. This is what I believe Jesus said. This is what I believe the Bible teaches. There's a power in just proclaiming what is there. But he also says that he's asking for prayer that he would proclaim it clearly. So that must mean that there are some words that we could use that would be unclear or would take people in the wrong direction. So we do need to think carefully about that. By the way, in a similar setting in Ephesians, when Paul asked the people there to pray for his evangelism, he said, pray that I may proclaim it boldly, fearlessly. So two different prayer requests, but both about evangelism. In here, he's praying, asking them to pray that he would make it clear. In the other one, it's pray that I may be fearless, so maybe bold. So we need to pray both of those things for ourselves. But there is a need for us to think about not just proclaiming it and proclaiming it clearly, but to do so with grace and salt. And let our speech be full of grace seasoned with salt. And what I think that means, at least, it means more, but it at least means it should sound like good news. It should sound kind. It should sound winsome. It should sound like you'd like to hear more, wouldn't you? Or maybe even a flavor of, doesn't this sound too good to be true? So as I've said on a number of occasions, when we proclaim the gospel, we want to make sure that we proclaim that this is true. We also want to say this is good. And we want to do both. I don't want to argue that one's more important than the other. They're both equally very, very important. In some conversations, we want to push more on the truth side. You'll notice at the end of this passage, Paul says that we might make it clear. He says that we would know how, sorry, he's telling us about us, that we would know how we ought to answer each person. Different people need different emphases. Just look at the way Jesus spoke to Nicodemus in John chapter 3 and the woman at the well in John chapter 4. Different content was stressed. For Nicodemus, it was very academic and theological. It probably had more emphasis on the truth side. You should believe this because the scriptures teach this. Nicodemus, you're a teacher of the Jews and you don't understand this? I'm trying to explain it to you. You should understand this. This whole concept of being born again is an Old Testament or a Hebrew scripture concept in Ezekiel and Jeremiah and other places. You should understand this because it's true. But in John chapter 4, the conversation was much more about, you should believe this because it's good. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could drink water that when you drank it, you'd never thirst again? If you believe in Jesus, he becomes a well of water springing up. Do you feel how good that would feel? And again, he was talking to a woman who had lots of failure in her relationships. She had five husbands and now she was living with a man and that wasn't working out so well. And so what Jesus was saying was, you're not going to find the goodness and thirst quenching that you're hoping for in relationships. You will only find it in the ultimate relationship with Jesus, the Messiah. So sometimes we want to stress the truth side, sometimes the good side, but we always want it to be with grace and salt. There needs to be ways of saying things so that people feel like, oh, this is good. We want to talk about how wonderful it is that we as Christians who have placed our trust in the finished work of Jesus the Messiah have all our sins paid for and they're all forgiven. We're not pretending to be sinless, not at all. In fact, we're more aware of our sin now. And when we confess it, we have this great confidence that I don't have to do anything to work for that forgiveness. It's already been paid for. Isn't that wonderful? I'm already forgiven. Or that I have a sense of purpose in life, even when the world around me seems purposeless and chaotic or absurd, because I know the God who created this world. I have a relationship with God that I can come to him at any time. He gives me a sense of purpose and blessedness. And so we need to be ready to talk about that graciousness. By the way, some of you who are listening to this, some Christians emphasize the truth side and they can be very dogmatic about it. Some of us press on the good side and we can compromise on the truth. So both sides have strengths, but also potential pitfalls and weaknesses. So you need to know who you are. Do you tend to be pounding the table and say, you need to believe this. Here are 57 arguments why it's true. Or are you someone who's so on the winsome side that you never get around to saying the difficult parts about the gospel, like sin and how sin separates us from God. And if we don't have that problem solved, we will stay separate from God for all eternity. That's what hell is. We need to find our ability to talk about hell, but we need to be able to talk about it in a way that it doesn't sound angry or harsh, other than just the harshness of the reality of what hell is like. And so we also need to have salt. Salt makes us thirsty. We need to say things in provocative ways or intriguing ways. We need to think about things, about how we would articulate them beforehand. Sometimes when people say things that I think are not true or just blatantly contradictory to the gospel, rather than pouncing on it and say, well, no, that's wrong, I say the word maybe. Well, maybe. But have you ever considered? Or I wonder if there's a better way to think about that. I disagree. Let me tell you why. And it's very important to insert pauses. It's very important to let people kind of receive something and start the acceptance of it gradually. I think that that's part of the grace and salt. I heard Tim Keller offer this illustration many, many times about, and he, I don't think he identified this as grace and salt, but it sure seems to me that it's a beautiful example of grace and salt. He told this story many times that when he first moved to New York City, they were planting a new church, and New York City already had lots of churches, and people regularly would say, well, what kind of church are you starting? You know, we have these churches in town that are, you know, always talking about hell and fire and brimstone. And then we have these other churches that never talk about that, but they're always talking about feeding the poor and taking care of justice issues. Which church are you? And very often they would ask the pointed question, are you one of those hellfire and brimstone hell preaching churches? Do you believe in hell and hellfire? And Keller gave this a lot of thought because he does believe in hell, and he did believe that, in fact, Jesus talked about it using terms about fire and flames that never die, that are never quenched. And so he didn't want to deny what the biblical teaching is. He didn't want to deny the fact that Jesus was the one who had the harshest descriptions of hell, and he was the one who used imagery of fire. But he just thought, if he just answered that question directly with, yep, we're one of those churches, we believe in hell, yep, it would close the conversation, it would end the conversation, and it wouldn't help people consider that maybe there's something here worth thinking about. And so he would say to people when they asked him about hell and fire, he would say, well, you know, I think all that imagery in the Bible about fire for hell, it might be a kind of metaphor. And people would go, oh, good, you're not one of those crazy fundamentalists. Okay, good. But then he would very quickly add, and if it is a metaphor, it's a metaphor for something far worse than fire. I think fire only begins to talk about how bad hell will be. It's a complete and total separation from all of God's love and all of his goodness and his grace. And that's horrible. Fire is just the beginning for how bad that is. And I think that that's a beautiful combination of both grace and salt. But having said that, and having spoken so very kindly, I hope, about Tim Keller, because I've been shaped and influenced by him so much, he's come into some criticism. Sadly, now that he's gone, he's with the Lord now. He died a little while ago. But people have been critical of Keller's approach, and people have said that his style of winsomeness no longer works in our world. They say that Keller was very, very effective during a time when there was a neutral attitude toward Christianity. People were neutral toward the gospel. They may have just thought, well, that's just what some people believe, but you know, if they want to believe it, that's fine. But today we're in a very negative world, and people are negative and, oh no, you're a Christian, you're part of the problem. And so Keller's approach to winsomeness, some of these people are saying, no longer applies and is no longer effective in our world, which has a negative attitude toward the gospel. And let me just jump in and say, I think those people are wrong. I think winsomeness still is absolutely necessary and is still the approach. It may have less effectiveness in our time, yes, but we're called more to be faithful than effective. We need to allow the effectiveness part of that be left up to the Lord. We do need to be wise. That's this passage that's talk about it. We do need to think carefully about what words are clear. But when people say that winsomeness no longer works, I just can't quite figure out what they're offering instead as a solution or as an alternative. Meanness, sarcasm, attacking, belligerency. I just don't know what's the tone instead of a winsome tone. But here's where I really want to dive in. I'm intrigued with the fact that Paul included the word always in this text. Do you see it there? In verse 6, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt. Always. Why did he include that word? And by the way, we have to realize if we're living in a negative time, negative toward the gospel, which I think we are, Paul was living in a time that was even more negative. He's writing this from prison. He was thrown into prison for preaching the gospel. People were imprisoned and killed for being faithful Christians back then. I'd say that's a pretty negative environment. I don't think we're quite that negative as Paul faced. And we need to know Paul was executed in prison for proclaiming the gospel. When he chose the word always in verse 6, he's saying it to a group of people who may have been very, very tempted to respond with unkindness, to respond with meanness and harshness, with meanness and harshness. They may have been tempted because they were surrounded by a harsh environment. The city of Colossae had lots and lots of alternative philosophies that were so absolutely contradictory to the gospel. And yet Paul said, always, always, don't compromise on this. Don't allow the tone of the culture around you to shape the flavor and tone of your words. And so in our world today, where there's very little kindness, and there sure is a whole lot of harshness on both sides, I think we need to be that rare exception of a voice that disagrees with kindness and gentleness. And that involves our tone of voice, how carefully we pay attention to people, what is going on our face as we sit across from them. We need to resist the temptation to be sarcastic and mean and just sound like the pundits on whether we watch this side of the news or this side of the news. They're both harsh. They're both sarcastic. We need to find a different tone of voice. Some of us need to talk more slowly. Some of us need to not answer right away. There's some great brilliance of just pausing after someone says something and for us to say, give me a second to think about that. Or to be able to say, thank you for sharing that. I need to think about it that way. But here's how I'm thinking about it right now. In our world today, we need to pray for people to respond with things like this. You know, you disagree with me, but you don't sound harsh. Why is that? Or you and I are completely disagree on so many things, but you don't sound mean. Why is that? And then there's that magnificent opportunity for us to talk about how kind God has been toward us. Kindness, the kindness of God. That's a word that's used in Titus chapter 3 when Paul recounts and restates the gospel message. When the kindness of God came to us. Think about how patient and gentle and kind God has been to you. And we need to allow that to flavor our evangelism, how the tone of our evangelism would be winsome in a world that is very, very harsh and unkind. I hope this is helpful for you. I hope this podcast episode is helpful. Please give us some feedback. Tell us, do you like this kind of stuff when Randy talks to himself alone in the studio? Or would you really rather that I do a whole lot more conversation with other people? And are these insights helpful? Welcome, old hat, things you've already heard before and don't need to hear again? Please let us know. We'd really appreciate that. In the meantime, we do pray that all that we do here at the C.S. Lewis Institute is helpful for you in your discipleship, in your heart and mind discipleship, so that you can love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Thanks.